Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we will continue now with the study of the Mahahatipadopama Sutta. This is the greater discourse, a longer discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. Okay, last week we finished the section on the earth element, the whole section. And so now we're on page 280, the section on the water element. Okay, so now Venerable Sariputta explains that the water element can also be either internal or external. And you remember what I explained, that at the philosophical level, the water element is the quality of fluidity or liquidity, and is also understood as that aspect of material phenomena which is responsible for cohesion, for the binding of material particles together. We can call it the cohesive property of matter. But this particular property or characteristic of matter becomes manifest or shows most distinctly in what we call fluids or liquids. And so we take as examples of the water element parts of the body that are of the internal water element, parts of the body which are fluids or liquids. So what are some examples of this? Sariputta says, whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, or we would say liquid, liquidish, and clung to organic. That is, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, urine, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is water, liquid, liquidish, and organic. This is called the internal water element. Okay, and then one develops this contemplation using the water element as the basis in order to gain the perception of non-self. One develops the contemplation of the water element in order to perceive or to discern the identity and characteristic between the internal water element and the external water element. So both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water element. So we take water, we drink several cups, glasses of water a day, tea, juice, whatever. The water that we drink then gets absorbed into the body. That's external water element. It becomes internal water element. The internal water element of the body, which is waste, then gets filtered through the kidneys, comes out the bladder, and then gets excreted in the form of urine. It then becomes external water element. So there's a constant exchange of internal water element, external water element becoming internal water element, internal water element becomes external water element. And so, when one sees this identity of characteristic between the two, then one sees that one cannot truly identify even this internal water element as being I, mine, or myself. And so one then sees it as it actually is with true wisdom. Thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees it thus, then one becomes disenchanted with the water element, and one's mind becomes, or one makes the mind dispassionate towards the water element. Okay, so that's one way to see the selfless nature of the internal water element. Then there comes another way, and that is by observing or reflecting upon the impermanence of the water element, even the external water element. And this is given in terms of this, the next passage. This is describing a great flood that's supposed to take place sometime in the future, and then the drying up of the waters when this was supposed to be the time of the destruction of this world system. Okay, there comes a time when the external water element is disturbed, then it carries away villages, towns, cities, and districts and countries and so on. That's the great flood. But then what happens is that, according to another sutra, this is in the Anguttara Nikaya, the book of the sevens, is that the sun splits and two suns appear in the sky. And then because of the heat of the two suns, the waters of the earth start to dry up. And so the water in the great ocean starts to sink down from its 100 leagues. It sinks down 200 leagues and so on. It keeps on going down, 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 until there's not even enough water to wet the joint of the fingers. And then even that water, that little residue of water, even that dries up, and all of the water on the earth eventually dries up. And so because of this, one could see that this external water element is impermanent, subject to destruction and disappearance. So what can be said of the water element in this body, this impermanent body? That too is impermanent. So there can no be, one cannot consider the water element in this body, this transient body, which lasts just 70 or 80 years. One can't consider this as being I, mine, or I am. Okay, paragraphs 13 to 15, these are developed on the same pattern as the paragraphs 8 to 10 based on the earth element. So we don't have to explain that in detail here. Then we pass on to the fire element. This too can be internal or external. Okay, what is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and organic. Then this is explained as that by which one is warmed. Okay, that's readily understandable. This is the natural heat of the body temperature in a normal person, 98.6, roughly 98.6. That by which one ages and is consumed. This maybe is a little obscure, but according to Indian physiology, it is the heat in the body that causes the body to manifest the signs of aging. It's the heat element in the body. And maybe we could see some indication of this if we have fruit and we leave the fruit out on a hot day. the fruit will dry, it will start to turn, to mature, and will dry up more quickly than if we refrigerate the fruit. If we refrigerate the fruit and keep it cool, then it lasts longer. And maybe vegetation as well, in cool climates, the vegetation will keep fresh, but when the sun is very strong, then the vegetation is seen to dry up and wither. And maybe from this, the Indian thinkers drew the inference that it is likewise, it's the heat element in the body that causes the body to age and to show the signs of aging. And so a person who has a very high degree of the heat element in the body, that person will show signs of aging at an early point in their life, whereas somebody whose heat element is less intense will remain fresh and youthful even into ripe old age. This is because of a difference in the intensity of the heat element in the body. So if one can keep the heat element under control, then one's body will remain more youthful and more vigorous up to a later stage in one's life. And also it's when the heat element gets agitated that one gets a fever and then one falls ill. So that's why it's said that it's because of the heat element that the body becomes consumed. And then also it's said that it's by the heat element that what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested. That is, the heat element, it's the fire element or heat element of the body is what is responsible for digestion. So the digestive juices, the digestive acid, what is it, hydrochloric acid in the stomach, works by burning up the food that one eats. It's a process of consuming the food. And the hydrochloric acid does that by burning, it's the heat element in the hydrochloric acid that burns up the food. And that's how the food gets digested. I know in Sinhalese, for hunger, they call hunger badagini, which means literally stomach fire. Badagini tienuada, which means, are you hungry, means literally, do you have stomach fire? Okay, so this is part of the internal fire element. And whatever else internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. This is said because there's the fire element throughout the body. Throughout the body, there's some bodily heat, and that is the functioning of the fire element. And so this is the internal fire element, and this internal fire element and the external fire element are both simply the fire element. They both have the same property of heat, with the same function of burning, consuming. Okay, and then the rest of this is developed in the same way in order to develop the contemplation of non-self. And then paragraph 17, we come to a passage which describes apparently it's describing an event which is supposed to take place when the world is being destroyed by fire. There comes a time when the external fire element is disturbed, and then it burns up villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries, and it consumes everything that it can. And then when it's burned up everything that will burn, then it uses up its fuel, and then it goes out due to lack of fuel. And then there comes a time when people try to make a fire, even using the cock's feather of the cocks, or hide parings, but they have nothing, no way to make a fire anymore, because the fire element apparently has all been consumed, and now the fire element has been exhausted within this world cycle. And so it said, when even this external fire element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change, what can be said of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a while? There can be no considering this as I or mine or I am. Okay, then paragraphs 18 to 20, these are developed according to the same pattern as paragraphs 8 to 10. Okay, then the next paragraph we come to the air element. This is the air element or the wind element. The air element has the abstract property of pressure, distension, and it's experienced as expansion and contraction. That's the way it becomes manifest in experience, as sensations of expansion and contraction. And again, according to the Buddhist analysis of matter, the air element or wind element is present in every material substance, even the very minute particles of matter, the air element is present in the form of vibration or oscillation. But the air element is most manifest in the form of winds, different winds. And so here, in explaining the air element, the internal air element, the Venerable Sariputta uses as examples the different types of winds in the body. So he says, what is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to or organic. That is, upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs of the body, in-breath and out-breath, and whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to. This is called the internal air element. Okay, the rest is developed according to the same pattern. And we could see how the internal air element and the external air element are in a constant process of interchange. We breathe in, we take in the air from the outside, the body absorbs the oxygen from the air and gives up its carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide gets breathed out, becomes part of the atmosphere. Again, we breathe in. The lungs absorb the oxygen gets integrated, assimilated into the cells of the body, the cells give up their carbon dioxide and the other waste gases and they get breathed out. And so when the oxygen gets assimilated into the cells, then it becomes what we call me, I, myself. When the waste gases get breathed out, then they become external air element. But there's no hard and fast barrier between the two. But we have a constant exchange going on between the two. The external becomes internal, the internal becomes external. So we can't say that one is truly myself and the other is not myself. Okay, then in paragraph 22, we have this another one of these accounts about the end days of the world, the destruction of the world. This is describing this terrible catastrophe in the future through the air element or the wind element. When the air element is disturbed, then it sweeps away villages, towns, cities, districts, and countries. But then the air element gets exhausted. And so then there comes a time in the last month of the hot season when people have to seek wind using a fan or bellows, and even the straw in the grasses hanging from the roof. This is the way people in the tropics, they make the roofs to their houses using grasses and fronds from like coconut palms they put on the roofs, straw. And usually when the straw is hanging down, when the wind blows, then the straw will blow back and forth. But when the air is very, very still, those strands of straw won't stir. So this is now describing the scene where there's just no wind blowing at all, because the wind element has become completely exhausted. And so when this external air element is seen to be impermanent, subject to disappear, during this time at one of these last stages of the world, so what can be said of this body, which is impermanent, subject to vanishing? There can be no considering this as I, mine, or I am. Okay, so then paragraphs 23, 25, this is developed on the same pattern as 8 to 10. Okay, now it starts to get interesting. If you remember in the first class, I said that Venerable Sariputta, he made this distinction between the four great elements and the types of form derived from the four great elements. And so now Sariputta has already explained the four great elements, and he put the type of form derived from the four great elements aside, just to explain the four great elements. Now, in paragraph 26, this is the way the commentary understands this, Sariputta is going to bring in the types of form derived from the four great elements. And he uses a simile. He says, just as when space is enclosed by timber and creepers, grass and clay, it comes to be termed a house, so too when a space is enclosed by bones and sinews, flesh and skin, it comes to be termed, here the text uses the expression rupang, material form, but it actually really means a body. And now space is one of the types of form derived from the four great elements. And some of the suttas actually speak about space as another element. For example, Sutta number 140, the analysis of the elements, speaks about the space element. And I think Sutta number 62, the discourse to Rahula, yeah, on page 529, speaks about the space element. And so according to the commentary, space element is here taken to represent the form derived from the great elements. And now in paragraph 27, Sariputta is going to go on to show how all five aggregates come into being. And last week I gave a handout which provides a schematism for this. It works this out schematically, but here we can just go through the text itself and then see how this particular pattern is developed from sentence to sentence. This is an extremely important passage because this passage is going to show how the five aggregates arise through each of the six sense bases. So this is one of the rare places within the Pali Suttas where we have these two different schemes for classifying experience, that is, the scheme of the six sense bases and the scheme of the five aggregates. Usually they're treated quite distinct from each other, but in this passage they're brought into connection with one another. Okay, so here Sariputta begins using the I base as the starting point. Okay, if the I is intact, that is, the I is unimpaired, no difficulties with the I, but no forms come into range, then there is no corresponding conscious engagement. Here the Pali word engagement means advertence or turning to the object. That is the turning of the mind to the object. If there's no turning of the mind to the object, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. That is, there's no arising of a type of I consciousness knowing or experiencing a form through the I. Okay, this should be obvious because here it said that forms have not come into range. For example, if the eye is intact, but one is in a completely dark room, or if one has blindfold over the eye so that one can't see anything at all, then there won't be an arising of an eye consciousness. If internally the I is intact and external forms come into range, but there is no corresponding conscious engagement, that is, there's no turning of the mind to the object. For example, suppose you're sitting, listening to a piece of music, you're completely involved with that piece of music. You're sitting, say a friend of yours passes by someplace in front of you, but you're listening and so involved listening to the music that you don't even notice that friend of yours. then you won't see your friend. Because even though the form has passed by, but there's been no conscious engagement, so there's no arising of that corresponding type of eye consciousness. Okay, but now in the third place, now we come to the case when the eye consciousness will arise. When internally the eye is intact, the vision is all right, no problem with the vision of the eye. And external forms come into range. And there is the corresponding conscious engagement. Something attracts the attention of the mind. Something causes the mind to turn to that form. Then there is the manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. In other words, then a type of eye consciousness will arise, knowing, seeing that form through the eye. And so we have a whole experience here, which we call an experience of, we call this the class of eye consciousness. The Pali actually uses an expression, vijnana bhaga, which means something like a section or portion of eye consciousness. And now what comes in paragraph 28 is very important. I like to change the sequence a little bit from that of the translation to follow that of the Pali. In what has thus come to be the material form is included in the material form aggregate affected by clinging or subject to clinging. In other words, here we take as primary this expression, tattabhutassa, what has thus come to be. And what has thus come to be here is this section or class of eye consciousness. And so the section of eye consciousness is not just the eye consciousness itself, but it's like a whole portion or section of experience, which is a rather complex event. And now Sariputta is putting that complex event, that section of eye consciousness, he's putting it under a microscope, the microscope of panya, of wisdom, and seeing what is incorporated within this experience of seeing a form with the eye, which is the section of eye consciousness. Within that section of eye consciousness, which is common to being, the aspect of material form, that goes into the material form aggregate, subject to clinging. Okay, so I try to illustrate this in this way. Okay, we have these conditions. Can you see? Can you see? Yeah, I will read it. It's when I come to, I'll read it when I come to it. Okay, we have the conditions for the arising of what we call the section of eye consciousness is that the eye is intact, forms come into range, and then there's this act of what's translated here as conscious engagement, but that really means the act of attention, the turning of the mind to the forms. And that gives rise to what is called the section, the particular section of eye consciousness. That is what is meant by what comes into being. What has thus come to be, that is the section of eye consciousness. And within this section or experience of eye consciousness, the material form that is there, this gets classified into the material form aggregate affected by clinging. So what is this material form that is there? We would say within that experience it will be the body itself of the experiencer, and particularly the eye as the organ of vision, and the forms as the objects of vision. Those would go all into the material form aggregate. And the feeling in what has thus come to be is included in the feeling aggregate affected by clinging. That is, when one experiences or when one knows those forms through the eye, when that eye consciousness arises, one will experience the forms in a particular way, either as pleasant or in a painful, either in a pleasant way, in a painful way, or in a way that's neither painful nor pleasant, in a neutral way. The perception in what has thus come to be is included in the perception aggregate subject to clinging. That is, within this experience there will be some perception. One perceives the form as being a particular type of form. This is the form of my friend. This is the form of a cup with a drink. That's a bird flying in the sky. Okay, the formations, we should say volitional formations, and what has thus come to be are included in the volitional formations aggregate affected by clinging. That is, when one sees the form, then there will arise certain volitions regarding that form. One wants to take a certain type of action in regard to it. If it's something nice, maybe one wants to get possession of it. If one sees a cup with a drink, then it would come, and one is thirsty, there'll come the volition of desiring to take a drink. If one sees a friend, there will come a volition, maybe of going to talk to him. If one sees an inspiring Buddha image, one will have volition to pay homage to it. So volitions arise within that experience of eye consciousness, and those volitions go into the formations aggregate subject to clinging. And then there is this consciousness or awareness itself arising based upon the eye. That consciousness is what is included in the consciousness aggregate subject to clinging. And so, though we speak about this experience as vijnana bhaga, a section or portion of consciousness. I write the Pali for that. But consciousness is only one part of that portion or section of consciousness. And we shouldn't think that this is a philosophical idealism which is treating everything as just a manifestation of consciousness, because the section of consciousness itself arises dependent upon the I and dependent upon forms which are not consciousness themselves. Okay, so now Sariputta says, when one reflects upon this, then one understands thus, this indeed is how there comes to be the inclusion, the gathering, the amassing of things. We say the classification of things into these five aggregates subject to clinging. And then he quotes the Buddha. He says, this has been said by the Bhagava, by the Blessed One. One who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma, and one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. But what's interesting, though Venerable Sariputta quotes the Buddha here as making this statement, but we don't find this statement anyplace else in the Sutta Pitaka. So this is an example of a statement that the Buddha must have made, but which has not been preserved anyplace else except in this quotation by Sariputta. And yet it's a statement which is extremely important because it underscores dependent origination, paticca-samuppada, as the key to understanding the whole teaching. Dependent origination is the essence of the Dhamma. And to understand the Dhamma, one has to understand dependent origination. And then these five aggregates subject to clinging are dependently arisen. That's what Sariputta has just shown. How are the five aggregates dependently arisen? Because these five aggregates have arisen through these conditions. They've arisen through the presence of the I being intact, forms coming into range, and attention. Through those conditions, eye consciousness arises. And then within that eye consciousness, within that section of eye consciousness, we locate all five aggregates. And so the five aggregates come into being depending on causes and conditions. And now, what is the origin of dukkha, of suffering? You see, the five aggregates affected by clinging or subject to clinging, that is the first noble truth, the noble truth of dukkha, which here doesn't mean suffering in the sense of experienced pain, misery, sorrow. But the deeper meaning of dukkha is the fact that these five aggregates come into being through conditions, that the world of constituted experience originates through conditions, that it's not something which is self-existing. And because it comes into being through conditions, it ceases with the cessation of its conditions, so it's everything within experience is impermanent, unreliable, undependable. Okay, and what is it that brings these five aggregates into being again and again at the beginning of any existence. It is the desire, indulgence, inclination, and holding based on these five aggregates subject to clinging. That is the origin of suffering. We could say at one level, we could say a level of ordinary experience, desire, holding, clinging, based on the five aggregates. This is the cause of experience suffering when things don't work out according to our desires, then one experiences suffering. That's what I call a psychological explanation of the relationship between the origin of suffering and the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering. But that's not the deepest level at which that relationship can be understood. At the deeper level, it is this desire, holding or clinging within the five aggregates that brings into being the five aggregates from one existence to another existence to another existence. So the clinging, my clinging to these five aggregates right now, if that clinging goes on and on right up to the time of my death, then that clinging will bring into being a new set of five aggregates, which will mark the event of rebirth. And that will be the continuation of dukkha into a new existence. Then in that new existence, there will be clinging to the five aggregates. And if that clinging continues on until the ending of that existence, that clinging will bring into being a new set of five aggregates into the life beyond that. And then the clinging based on those five aggregates will bring into existence another set of five aggregates to start the existence beyond that. And in this way, the cycle of birth and death rolls on from life to life to life to life after life after life. So how does one bring this process to an end? That's what is stated in the next sentence. The removal of desire and lust, the abandoning of desire and lust for these five aggregates affected by clinging is the cessation of suffering. Okay, at one level, one could say one abandons desire and lust for these five aggregates, and so whatever happens to the five aggregates, there's no sorrow, no grief, no misery. That's one level to understand the cessation of suffering. But at the deeper level, what it means is that when the desire and lust or the clinging to the five aggregates is eliminated, then when this particular set of the five aggregates comes to an end, then there's no more arising of the five aggregates in the future. The cycle comes to an end. Okay, then this is repeated for each of the other senses, the ear base, nose base, tongue base, body base, mind base. With the mind base, there's an interesting case. I don't know how to understand this. It's the middle one. If internally the mind is intact, and external mind objects come into its range, but there is no corresponding conscious engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness. This seems to be saying that it's possible for mind objects, mental phenomena, to be passing through my mind without me being consciously aware of them. It seems almost as though, say, 2,400, 2,500 years before Freud, it's speaking almost of a subconscious. And one actually does notice something like this in meditation, when the mindfulness starts becoming sharper, one could see how so many things are passing through the mind every second. And yet, one reflects, is this happening all the time? Or is it just the meditation which is making this happen? It's not that the meditation is making this happen, but this is happening all the time. It's just that because one's mindfulness is not developed and is not focused so sharply and precisely on one's internal states of mind, that one is not aware of how quickly and subtly mental images, thoughts, mental functions take place and just pass away without registering, without having any kind of conscious impact. But when one starts attending to the flow of mental events, then one will start picking up more and more and bringing them into consciousness. And yet this is what is happening all the time in the course of our day-to-day lives. And when we are not registering the impact of these momentary mental events, those mental events still have their impact upon our minds and our characters and subtly transform them in ways that we're not aware of. In that way, we become sort of passive victims of the workings of our own mind. But it's by strengthening and heightening the power of mindfulness, the power, the capacity to attend to what is taking place in the mind, that we make the contents of the mind more accessible to conscious awareness, and then we have a better understanding of what is taking place in the mind, and we're better able to transform the mind. Okay, then it's in this third case, when the mind is intact and external mind objects come into range, and there is the corresponding engagement or attention, that there is the manifestation of the corresponding class of consciousness, that is mind consciousness. And then in that mind consciousness, in the same way, we have the analysis into the five aggregates. Everything else is stated in the same way. And then Venerable Sariputta sums up each of these sections by saying, at that point too, friends, much has been done by that bhikkhu. This is a monk who has performed this very precise analysis of his experience into the five aggregates through each of the sense bases, then has understood how these five aggregates arise through conditions, how the five aggregates are a process under the sway of dependent origination, and then he's able to understand this process in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And even though the noble truth of the path isn't mentioned explicitly in the sutta, but the whole process of meditation is actually an application, we could say, of different factors of the path, especially of right mindfulness and right view. Okay, and that takes us to the end of the simile of the elephant's footprint. Any questions?
Ms. Pandit, could you please explain more about Vijnana Padma? Does this phrase occur in some other places in the Pali language?
I think this is the only place where it occurs. Yeah. I haven't seen it anyplace else.
So what is the meaning of Vijnana Padma?
It just means that Bhaga means something like a portion or share, section of consciousness.
Is this thought in the time of the Buddha or later on to there? And probably some when people compiled the sutta and then arranged for this thought.
I think this is pretty early. We'd have to compare with the Agama version to see whether there's a corresponding term there. We also have to remember this is Venerable Sariputta speaking. So he uses words which would not be exactly the same words that the Buddha uses. And this seems to be almost like we could see here a little bit like a beginning of a kind of abhidhammic type of analysis.
Is it possible that some followers that of Sariputta that compiled this system in this way? That's why this word is only used in this place, where in other places they do not use this place.
Yeah, this is something that I can't know for sure. It's quite possible that the expression itself was original with Sariputta, and that it occurs only in the sutta because this is a sutta spoken by him. Just like this particular mode of analysis, one doesn't find in any other sutta, analyzing the five aggregates through the six sense bases. It's quite unique to the sutta.
So, Vijnana Padma means the consciousness in that specific, for example, seeing, hearing, because consciousness is a stream. But it's only in that section.
Yeah, the way I understand it, I take Vijnana Bhaga to be not just the aggregate of Vijnana, not just the aggregate of consciousness, but to be the whole experience of which Vijnana or consciousness, you could say, is the chief factor. But you see, the word bhaga means something like a portion. It's like if we had a pie and we cut up the pie, we'd call the different pieces of the pie a bhaga. And so here, this is a portion of consciousness. So within that portion, consciousness, the consciousness aggregate is just one part. But the other parts that go with consciousness are also part of this portion or section of consciousness. And so I think that's the implication of the word bhaga here, that it's, you know, like a hunk or section in which there are the different aggregates occurring together with consciousness.
So can we say that way, the five aggregates is the through the manifestation of the consciousness manifested through that experience.
I wouldn't want to say that the five aggregates are the manifestation of consciousness, because then that is almost a little bit slanting towards a kind of idealistic interpretation. Because rupa itself is not a manifestation of consciousness. Rupa form is a distinct aggregate from consciousness. It has its own characteristic, which is distinct from the characteristic of consciousness. But what one could say is that within the section, what the sutta calls a section of consciousness, one finds all five aggregates, including the aggregate of form. But one can't say that form is a manifestation of consciousness. If you say form is a manifestation of
consciousness, it's because these five, they have to come together.
They occur together, yeah.
And in the very first verse of Dhammapada, it says it's a mind name. So in this way, it is this consciousness. Through this consciousness. Then the five aggregates at every moment is different, it's always changing.
Yeah. Yeah, but still one can't reduce, you can't reduce them to consciousness.
Another question, how do you understand that the changing of consciousness at that moment? The changing of form, I think, is easiest because the consciousness changes to. But how come consciousness changing to itself at that moment?
The clinging is not at the very moment that the consciousness arises. There's not the very moment that consciousness arises. There's not necessarily clinging there. The clinging will arise, as I understand it, only when one experiences something and then one relates to that with desire and attachment. Or present, even present. But it's when the desire and attachment arise that it's called clinging. But this is called, when it's called the consciousness aggregate subject to clinging. Vijnana upadana khanda. It means that this aggregate can be taken as an object by clinging. It doesn't necessarily mean that there is clinging occurring within that aggregate of consciousness. Otherwise it would just be clinging occurring all the time, which is not the case. Any further questions? Do you understand that about clinging? That it doesn't have to, it's not necessarily present all the time. But these are still called upadana khanda in the sense that upadaniya, that they can be clung to, that they're potential objects of clinging.
Based on our experience, and then we cling either to the past or the future.
Or to the present, yeah. In any three periods of time.
My meaning is that when in that moment, in that section of I consciousness, how come that consciousness will cling to itself? It seems to me consciousness, because there is a theory of the four stations of consciousness. The consciousness will cling to form, perception, and it says that suppose consciousness do not cling to them, then consciousness itself is already free, because name and form are dependent. Suppose
Name and form and
consciousness. Yeah. Suppose consciousness do not cling to them, then consciousness has no place to
get a foothold.
Then it's liberated. So then my question, how come that in that particular experience, how come we say that consciousness will cling to itself?
It's just some texts speak about that when consciousness is not clinging to any of the four aggregates, then it's liberated. But there are some texts which also speak about consciousness clinging to consciousness. But it seems that consciousness cannot cling. The act of consciousness, which is clinging, cannot cling to itself at the same time. So it's clinging to consciousness in the past or in the future. Okay, then I think we have to stop now. I have to just repeat what I also said last week or 2 weeks ago, that we won't have the class November 7th, election day. That's next week. So the next class we have November 14th. And for the next class, I will take sutta number 64. This is the Mahamalankya Sutta. Okay, so let us close with sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam. Etavataca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavataca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.